Dum, 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 dum.
So that's not the right one.
Share screen. Can everybody see that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, let's see how long it is.
I can summarize this if you want, Tom.
Sure, that'd be great. Thank you.
Rebecca has suggested and put forward a first draft of what she was looking for in an idling law. And obviously what she pulled from was a lot of the stuff that's in other laws around the state. And this all started when DEC regulates heavy trucks and limits the amount that they're idling, but cities, towns have the right to adopt their own rules limiting idling. And the only real guidance from the state on that is that you can't limit it or ban a reasonable amount of time for idling, but that's not defined. I did a search on the state of filed laws. I don't pretend that it was a comprehensive one, but I got a good selection of them. And the limitations on idling range from anywhere from 1 minute to 30 minutes, believe it or not, which doesn't seem like much of a limitation. So what I did in here is put it in as a as 1 minute as a suggestion. Sorry, Tom, you may want to scroll down. And then there are exemptions for who it doesn't apply to. And these are fairly standard across the state. Many of them are included in the originated in the DEC regulations. They've been tweaked by various places. I kind of picked, you know, the best of everything. But in essence, of what it excludes is obviously if you're stuck in traffic, emergency vehicles and public utility vehicles performing emergency services. Anytime where there's a federal or state regulation that governs like the temperature in a bus, any engine where you're basically loading, unloading, or have to keep it running for a refrigerator truck, that's D. What I did not include that is in a lot of other things, because I just didn't think it was relevant to the city, we can put it in if I'm wrong, is specific exemptions for farming or mining activities or lumbering activities. Many places have those because they simply just, I think, copied them in, even though some of the towns wouldn't have those anyway. But I just didn't include it because it didn't matter. E, regarding diesel vehicles below 25, that's somewhat taken from the DEC standard. It's also pulled from some of the others. Not every town has that. I believe that goes to the question of that a lot of diesel vehicles have to be maintained and run below a certain temperature, but I just throw that out there from things that have often been seen. And then, of course, hybrids that have to idle for a little while while they're recharging their energy. And we make it apply to everywhere in the city. And then the enforcement provisions. Part of this was a problem of how to work it into the code or where to put it. So I put it under the vehicle and traffic law. And I put it as a chapter following the existing one, or the article, excuse me, on penalties. Because otherwise we've got to renumber all the rest of it. And it's that makes things more complicated. We can do it, but it I think it was okay just to throw it at the back. And so I took the fine and imprisonment language that we currently use for speeding tickets and put it equivalent to those, and reference the enforcement by the police and the parking enforcement officers. And I think that's really all, you know, that's the main points in terms of what's there.
Yeah. So there's just two things that are significantly different. One is that I had included a section about signage requiring parking lots to have signage that states that there's a, that, you know, that just basically outlines this law and tells what the fine is. In going around, I notice many people in parking lots sitting in their cars with the engines on. And I think it would be an important part of this law to, you know, because police officers don't generally, or parking enforcement officers don't generally patrol parking lots, I don't believe. So,
well, they patrol the municipal lots.
Mm-hmm. Right. But this would be, this is supposed to be applicable to any parking lot, like private established, privately owned, anything.
Right. I think there might be some questions about going on the private property for that. I mean, in terms of the signage requirement, I didn't leave that in. I haven't seen similar requirements in other laws. I think is a bit of a question on requiring signage on private property.
I did take that from another law, which I can find for you.
Okay. I'd be interested in seeing it. I mean, it's, you know, somewhat of a policy question of where you want to put it. I think certainly signage in municipal lots, is the city could do that. Right. That would be wise.
Right. And that doesn't have to be part of the law.
That doesn't have to be part of the law. That would just be a direction to DPW to put in the signage.
Right.
I don't know. But I don't know if it's going to be enforceable in private lots, because I know HPD can't enforce if somebody's not parked in a handicap parking, they can't enforce in a private lot. So I don't know if it's enforceable in private lots, like, you know, like crosswinds or anything like that. It's not going to be enforceable there.
So it says, I mean, right above, it's in 30544, it says persons responsible. This article shall apply to any person or entity who owns, operates, leases, supervises, or who otherwise has charge, blah, 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 of any such vehicle, and to any person who owns, leases, or occupies land and has actual or apparent domain or control over such vehicle or engine which is present on such land. So it seems like it does have a jurisdiction, I guess is the word, over private property.
Just because we say this in the law doesn't mean it gives the authority of the police to enter onto private property.
Exactly.
Right. It's a statement of the law, and it's a different question. People say it. This doesn't, you know, question, you know, there are different questions of enforceability.
Uh-huh.
What about people that live in their cars?
What?
What about people that live in their cars?
That live in their cars?
Yes, homeless people that live in their cars.
Well, they shouldn't be idling.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's, you know, obviously people do live in their cars. They have, I mean, the idea that, I mean, honestly, I don't know what to say to that. It's like definitely not a situation that it's where it's advisable for anyone to be idling a car for warmth, is I think what you're saying. Like, that's actually like a hazard for the person themselves too, for carbon monoxide and other things. You know, so like that person.
And if they're outside. It's true, but people do it now because there's a lot of poor people who are housing stressed and they live in their cars in the wintertime, unfortunately. And that does happen.
And now we're going to give them the fine for struggling, for trying to survive. I mean, I understand, you know, and I'm all for it with clean air, so to put it that way. I just think we need to look into it a little bit more because. You know, we have homeless people, and just because we see certain people in the park doesn't mean we're not paying attention to people that are in the cars. You know, I see people sitting in their cars, especially now during the pandemic, waiting for takeout food or picking up their children or dropping somebody off, waiting for them to come out of CVS, online, waiting for their prescription, you know, things
so
of that
people,
nature.
People definitely idle their engines. But that's what this is meant to address. Like, generally, there is no actual reason to idle your engine.
So let me ask you this, Rebecca, because I don't drive. I'm a passenger. So, you know, when people sit in their car because for whatever reason, and I'm for the reasons that I just stated is the ones that I've experienced. So when people are doing those things, aren't they wasting their gas?
Yes, they're wasting their gas.
I know a lot of people don't like to waste their gas. So I don't know if it wasn't necessary for them sitting in the car. I don't know anyone that just leaves their house to sit in their car.
No, honestly, Tiffany, it's one of the like incredible inconsistencies and ironies of human behavior. It doesn't make any sense, yet people do it. So this law is meant to address that.
But I'm just trying to understand, is this what you are noticing in the city of Hudson, or is this something that you just notice overall anywhere you go? I don't see that here.
Oh, I definitely do. Any walk, if I walk up and down Warren Street, I'm going to see at least 4 cars just sitting with their engines running. The other day I was sitting.
That's my whole point. You see them sitting, they're waiting for something. They're waiting for their food, a person to come out. That's like a cab. They're sitting outside waiting for the person to come out.
Waiting for something doesn't mean that you can idle your engine.
So with this law, resolution law that you want to see put forth, are you expecting the police to time people?
No.
They say, wait, you've been in your car for over 30 minutes because we walked by a couple of times and now you're getting a fine?
It's a 1 minute limit. The other thing that has changed from how I had drafted it was that they would the first time they would receive a warning, and then the second time a fine, and then the third time a larger fine.
I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know. I don't see what you see, and if when you see it after this meeting, record it, send it to me so I can see it, because I just see people waiting for a specific reason and leaving.
But what I'm trying to say is, just because they're waiting for something doesn't mean that they can idle their engine. Like waiting is not a time where you can leave it.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm just trying to put it together with what I see that's actually happening. That's like saying, no one can smoke on the street anymore because they're secondhand smoke, outside of the parks and out on the sidewalk. You can't have a beat.
I think that, Tiffany, the part of what you're saying that I don't really follow is you seem to be saying that you think that when you see somebody idling their engine, that they're engaged in something else. I don't quite understand what you're saying, but the purpose of this law, I had kind of laid out a whole bunch of whereases, which have to do with some state laws. That are like, there's something called the Climate Act, which is actually an emissions reduction mandate that, essentially like people throughout the state in the governments, in all the different governments, are being asked to figure out how to actually create conditions which will produce an emissions reduction by, I believe it's like 40% emissions reduction by 2030, something like that. So this is just one small but significant part of things that have to happen, is that we have to not have people sitting in cars idling their engines.
Hold on a second, everybody. Sorry.
I would love to hear.
Okay, Tiffany,
go ahead, Jen, go ahead.
Can I just, okay. Yeah. I don't mean to step on your toes, Tiffany, but I want to ask Rebecca a question. The purpose of this law, or any law in my estimation, is that it is reasonable and enforceable. And while I could understand the reasonableness of this because it's consistent with concern about climate and auto emissions, I don't quite understand how this practically is enforced. And if it's a minute, is there somebody standing around timing people? If you go run and get a police officer and say, this guy has been idling his engine, I don't understand passing a law for the sake of passing a law if it's not realistically enforceable. And I'm lost on this. Can you please elaborate?
That's my whole point. And I want to hear from the rest of the committee as well, because that's exactly what I mean. And if they're sitting idling in their car and they say to the police officer, I have a newborn baby, it's cold, and I'm waiting for my husband to come out with the prescriptions for the baby. And you want me to turn the car off? And then they get a fine for that? I don't understand.
Can you? So Rebecca, could you, for both Tiffany and myself, and perhaps others on this committee, could you play out why and how this is enforceable?
Before you do that, Rebecca, I'd like to just add that if this law passes, it gives us more credits on our Climate Smart Communities application. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the more things you do to satisfy the Climate Smart Communities list of things to do, the more credits you get, and that, of course, makes you more eligible for grants. So it's not that unusual. And it does enhance your climate status.
That's wonderful for the city to receive grants. And I'm sure we're all behind.
I'm not asking you to say what. I'm just telling you this.
No, I understand that.
I'd like to respond to the question that I was asked.
That, just because we're gaining points doesn't mean we're going to put people to have fines to gain points. It's just.
I understand that.
And I would like you to answer James' question, Rebecca, because
here goes. So enforcement, as it's drafted here, is the same way that speeding tickets or other kinds of traffic tickets are enforced. There's parking officers, and there's traffic officers, and there's police officers, and they will enforce as they. Did I freeze?
No.
So they will enforce the law to the best of their abilities. I mean, that's how they do it.
Are you expecting the city to hire people? Because we couldn't even get the police to be to come to City Hall to do hourly check-ins. So I just don't. I want to understand. Are you expecting the city to hire? No,
there are already police who patrol. Right, they patrol the streets and they patrol around for various things. And so this is just one thing that they add to what they're looking out for. They're looking out for people idling their engines, which is.
So you giving this responsibility to the police and not the traffic officers?
Let's see. What does it say in enforcement here? What does it say?
Hold on.
You have to scroll again.
I am.
And are you still looking for the city to hire more staff?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think this is such an onerous burden upon the police officers and parking.
It says enforced by police officers and parking enforcement officers.
So, but back to the question of who is it that sits and idles their engine? It's the example you're giving, newborn baby, medication, waiting at the drugstore. I mean, typically, people can get out of their car and go into a drugstore, is one thing. Like, if it's really, so brutally cold out, and don't sit in the car. And the vast majority of people who I see idling their engines are just doing it because they feel like it, not because they have some good reason to do it. They're doing it because they think that it's okay. And the purpose of the law is to demonstrate that, in fact, it's not okay. And I'm sorry, is somebody talking?
I was going to chime in if I could.
Not yet. But so, I'll give as an example, the person that I saw on the street the other day who was sitting in his car. Can somebody turn off their microphone? Maybe, I don't know who it is, but. Anyway, there was a guy sitting in an SUV on Warren Street, just running the engine. I was sitting at Rev outside. So I was sitting there for a while, and it was just going and going and going, probably 10, 15, 20 minutes. And I went over and I said, I'm sorry, can you shut your engine off? And he said, I'm charging my phone. Like, that's not a good reason to idle your engine.
Well, you know what, Rebecca? In certain parts of New York City, they have stations out where people and homeless people and just general people of the public can charge their phones. Because that happens. There's an emergency situation and you need to have your phone on.
This was not an emergency, okay?
I what that person's emergency
also,
is.
Well, I know what a climate emergency is, okay? And we're having one. So this is like, I'm sorry, you need to figure out how to charge your phone in some other way.
I understand. I don't want to speak now, please. I understand that this... And I support the law generally because of climate reasons, but in particular, just making a law based on your anecdotal observations without saying we need to have something in here that says a warning, perhaps, because I've had to wait for someone to come out. Hold on a second. I've had to wait for someone to come out. The police have come up to me already in the times I've lived in Hudson and told me to move my vehicle or park it. So they generally do this. If we're asking the police now to more aggressively, travel around and make sure that people who are blocking traffic or idling in their cars unnecessarily move them, warn them first. But I think saying a minute is kind of absurd. And I think we should be encouraging the police to warn people and then fine. Because just basically saying like, I walk around and I see houses are painted blue and then over here houses painted yellow. I mean, that's not a way to make a law. I know idling is a problem and bad.
Yeah, and I mean, I really resent the idea that it's just anecdotal, given that many...
That's all you're saying, Rebecca, is anecdotal evidence, so don't resent it. It's the truth of how you're presenting it.
Exactly, exactly. Sure. It sounds like you want this law passed over a personal reason or because of this example that you gave. And it's and for what people are dealing with, and I'm not talking just in general of Hudson, but we're talking about everywhere... You know, with people are dealing with police, like we don't need something else as far as with this law, with as far as people saying they're being harassed by the police. They move their car, they're still coming back to me. I turn my car off, they're still coming. Like, you should have some proof. Like, look at the evidence, because I don't see what you see.
Okay, well, you know, yeah. So I agree with the idea that there should be a warning and, you know, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. The top number that I saw when I read through a whole bunch of these around the state was 3 minutes. So that's what
The top number I saw anywhere was the top number I saw anywhere was 30 minutes, which I agree was ridiculous. The majority were in the 3 to 5.
Have you ever spoken with the traffic officers and asked them how long have they seen people wait outside of CVS or a restaurant or anything to determine the waiting time?
Why would that be relevant, Tiffany?
Why? Because you wanted it to be 60 seconds. That's why when they could...
Because the point is that I don't agree that somebody waiting outside a restaurant for food is a reason that they can idle their engine.
Well, that was one example. I just gave you one of a newborn coming out the hospital with the other parent getting their medication while the other parent is in the car staying warm with their child. So I agree with John. It should be a warning or maybe some education behind it. But not just get out of here. You got a minute. Here's a fine. That's
no. I think a warning is a great idea. That was how I had originally drafted it.
But as far as the time, that's what you were determined to put in the law because you have these facts from our traffic officers, from our police officers, from the timeline or from the warnings that they already given, as John stated, as what he already sees. So that would help us out to support this even more. For the city, because you're saying I spoke to these officers that work from 9 to 5, 9 to 3, and these are the examples that they gave us or gave you of what they see, of what they do, and the tickets that they give out and the warning that they deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hold on, Rebecca. Other councilmen would like to speak. I'm not sure who put their hand up first, so let's go with Ryan first.
All right. I mean, overall, I like it. And I like it from the perspective of giving us the credits that we know that we need to be able to get more funding, because the environmental credits can then be applied, the environmental grants can then be applied more broadly. One suggestion that may be a middle path here for everyone is we are going to be doing that parking study with the money that was set aside from the mayor's office. Do we roll in and ask to have idling monitored as well? Because then we've got neutral third-party empirical evidence that we can say, okay, while you were looking at the parking situation on XYZ different dates, how many cars did you witness idling? Approximately how long? And then this way, it's a little bit irrefutable outside of our own observations and then those of the police department as well. And it really gives us something to root into to be able to pass this. I just wanted to offer that.
Thank you, Ryan. Next is Dominic.
Thank you. So two things that I think one thing we're asking, again, to make a law without law enforcement input. And I think that's very valuable. Second thing is, I mean, I'm sure possibly credits could be also given if we start a campaign rather than making the law initially to educate the importance of not idling, you know, what they're saving, the benefits to our city, you know, a universal campaign citywide, and, you know, to get people on board and, you know, supporting this initiative. And see how that works. And then if there's no reduction in, or whatever, then, you know, figure that out. But I don't know about making a law that right now there's going to be certain parts of it that aren't going to be enforceable. And 1 minute is just, I mean, I have somebody, you know, when somebody picks me up sometimes, they're waiting more than 1 minute. And that's not on them. That's on me getting to the car. And if it's in the winter months, to turn off the car, you know, or to, you know, I don't know if that's realistic. And again, we got senior citizens, whatever the reasons of keeping a car warm. We have co-work that makes, you know, they have to have their car, you know, because of air conditioning, picking up individuals at their home during programmings, you know, so I don't know. I don't know. We have to really think this through. We need more input and before we really make this a solid thing.
Thank you. Oh, Rebecca, hold on.
I just want to respond to one thing Dominic said, which is just to point out that the draft here does say that, like, if a vehicle is mandated to have the climate, to be climate controlled for the passengers, that that's an exception.
Okay. Jane, please. You're next.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Rebecca, I think one point of your laws is, or one point of your suggested law makes sense, because in our ward, Rebecca, that you and I both perhaps ably represent, the idling issue off Warren on Allen Street in front of Talbot and Arting, I've observed to be at times egregious. But here is a practical application that I wonder about and how you would see this law addressing this issue. Somebody is sitting in his or her car having their sandwich, and it's either cold out or it's hot out. One way or another, they're running their car to adjust their own personal climate bubble while they're having their lunch. What is one to do? You're not going to have cops on Allen Street, you know, rolling up and down. You're not going to have traffic control people. Does somebody who observed this call the police and say, please come, there's an illegal idler having their bologna sandwich, and I wish to, you know, report them? What is the practical application for these incidents that occur off the high traffic areas of Warren Street?
Before you answer, Rebecca, I don't think Talbot and Arctic sells bologna sandwiches. But Rebecca...
Tom, you're being picky.
Sorry. John has his hand up. Do you mind if Rebecca responds first, John?
Go ahead,
Rebecca.
I mean, you know, this is a matter, Jane, I mean, your question is a matter of deep, deep significance. It comes down to, like, you know, how responsible do people feel for their environment, essentially, and, like, I know I'm one of those people. I'll take down somebody's license plate number and I'll, you know, knock on their car window and I'll say, you know, this is, I'm sorry, but there's a law in and you're breaking it. And here's how. And if you do it again, you know, I'm going to report you, basically.
But you're powerless. I'm sorry, I don't want to argue with you, Rebecca, but you and me and you know, my neighbors who observe this stuff, who have mentioned it to me, this very circumstance of idling cars, are powerless to do that. You can write down the envelope, or you can write down the license plate, you can send it in to the HPD, and you can say, that guy was idling in front of Calvin and Arting having his non-bologna sandwich for 20 minutes. And how does this, I mean, this is exactly to your point, and I just don't understand how it's enforceable.
Well, I guess one of the things is that, like, just being told sometimes can be a deterrent, you know? I mean, they can actually sort of be like, oh, I didn't actually really realize that was a law, and maybe I better not do it.
Oh, and I think, okay, thanks for telling me. I think I'll turn off my car. Okay, well, you know what? Next time I observe someone, I'm going to send you a text, and you can come and deal with them. Because
if it's a law, I'll be happy to.
Excuse me, hold on. I think
I'll come right over.
I'll be happy to know you're on the case.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Okay. John, go ahead.
Again, ultimately, I think we all know that carbon contributes to climate change. So an idling law is grounded. We don't really need to necessarily study. We should talk to the police. We should maybe get some input from a parking study. But in general, I support the idea. An idling law would be a good thing. Again, in particular, though, the idea that a lot of traffic laws tend to punish poor people more than we think, we have to be pretty fair about how we're going to do it and give people a warning, and also just understand that a lot of this lays on the police department. And generally, like, I'm not in favor of totally making deputizing citizens constantly to be snitches on other people for their behavior, but maybe the salutary effect of knowing that a law is in place against idling because it's climate-based will stop people from doing it. But again, it's going to be on the HPD to travel around, and they should warn people first and then continue on their way, and if they come back and that car is still there, then they could proceed with a ticket. But just let's go that way first before we move in.
Thank you. Hold on, Tiffany. Hold on. Jeff is up next, and then I'll get to you.
Let me just say, I agree with a lot of things that are being said, but a lot of it is, you know, I think it is a given that people idle excessively. Not everybody, but some people do. And some people are just rude and they won't do it and they won't stop it when somebody says, and I know people go up to them, and I think I've done it, said, you know, can you turn your car off? And unless you tell them, you know, there's actually a law, you can't be idling more than a certain period of time, they're going to flip you off half the time because people are rude. So it is useful to have that, to say that there is a law there. Now, I would strongly suggest that we change it to at least 3 minutes. Not 1 minute. I think that is too short. I think 3 to 5 makes sense. I think it does make sense that we run this by the police department and they get their input on it. Rebecca did have a provision in there for warning language. I didn't like a lot of the language in it, but I could certainly rework it to add in a presumption that there will be a warning first before somebody is just given a ticket. I think that makes sense. And it has essentially, you know, this effect of shaming people into behaving properly. You'll always have issues of enforcement. You have issues of enforcement now with anything. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be perfect. I don't think I would trigger or write in a snitch provision into the law. I don't think that's necessary. I think if somebody, again, you either see somebody do it and you inform them and hopefully they behave, or you're not comfortable doing that, you stop the parking enforcement officer who's walking down the street, or if you happen to see the police, or you can drop a call to the police department if you're concerned about it. But I think just collectively having it on the books, besides that it gets you points for the climate smart community thing, this is a useful thing. It's not onerous to people, and it doesn't turn you into a police state. It's an important thing, you know, that's useful to do.
Thank you, Jeff. And now the last two comments, Tiffany, and then Rebecca.
So, as it is important, you know, as we all agreed, as far as the reasons behind it, But I want to know, Rebecca, before you brought this to the attention of Tom and Jeff Baker, did you go out to the first ward and hand out information or pamphlets about this upcoming law just to give your constituents a warning of a possible fine that they would receive by doing this? Because with me, you know, when these things come about, especially if I know about it ahead of time and it wasn't something, resolution or law that I was bringing forth, I talk to my constituents to get their feedback and bring that to the council, you know, so I don't get hit with it. Why did they do this? You didn't warn us. You didn't tell us. Why did they just want to give me a ticket? Or whatever the reason may be.
Right.
So I just want to, because I'm curious as far as that, and I know you've seen me active in my ward. So I just want to know, did you give anyone the heads up?
Well, so because this is not a law yet, I haven't.
It doesn't matter. It's what you brought to the table. That's why we're discussing it tonight. Did you give anyone a heads up?
Well, there's nothing to give a heads up about.
Yes and no. Okay.
So, but if it passes, then I definitely agree with the idea that people need to get educated that this is a law and that they need to know about it so that they don't get caught unawares. And back to that education point that Ryan brought up, I do think that the signage, I mean, and also just what Jeff just pointed out, which definitely I think, I mean, that for me, that's a huge benefit to actually, as he said, having a law on the books, is like it does give people authority to actually, you know, say what's actually true. And but the signage, like, for example, Talbot and Arding could be, you know, just as a good neighbor, if they want to be as a good neighbor to the community and the neighborhood, they would post a sign outside of their door saying no idling, you know.
Okay, let's end it here. Sorry, Dominic. I said just these last two because we don't want to spend the entire meeting talking about idling. Well, you can call him up afterwards, Tiffany.
Can I just have one question to Jeff?
I have a question too. So yes, sure.
Thanks. So as it stands, I'm just curious. So if somebody is in their own private driveway, and you have a car starter, and it's winter months. Technically, if they start that car because they're trying to warm it up for whatever reason, they can get a ticket.
I think as written, it would, yes. I mean, I think that's an interesting point you raise, and it's sort of the question of do we provide for, and I've seen in some laws, in different language, that all of these exemptions, or put it differently, the law doesn't apply if the general temperature is below 25 degrees or 32 degrees, or you can pick a number of it. I think that's defeats a lot of the purpose of the law, because people sit there, I mean, to the point of, as I think Jane made, what about somebody who buys the sandwiches and sitting in their car and eating it and keeping their car going so they can keep the heater or the air conditioner going? Well, I agree with Rebecca on that. That's not really what we should be promoting, is that everybody keeps their own little generator going in their, you know, which is their car, so they're comfortable on it. You either, you know, it's not too cold, you eat in your car, you go someplace else, or you do something, or, you know, or you let it idle for a few minutes, warm it up, and then turn it off. You know, starting the car ahead of time, Dominic, you know, the council wants to, I can put something in there for that. And that's what I was going to ask Tom in terms of just going on to the next iteration. I just want to make it clear, we're going to add a warning provision.
Correct.
We're going to change it to a 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever people want.
Three.
5 minutes.
No. 5 minutes is a long time.
I'm going to write it for three. You can change it later.
We can still, yeah.
And I'm going to send this to the chief for his input on it.
Three, not just Rebecca.
Hold on, Tiffany.
You're not making a final decision here now. It goes to the full council. You'll have a discussion there, too. We can decide at any time along there how you want to change it.
Question mark next to the three.
Yeah, no, we'll do it as a bracketed number or something. Do you want me to try and put in a language along what Dominic had for starting a car at when it's cold or when it's hot. I mean,
may I just respond to that, which is that, you know, like the whole thing of warming the engine up has actually become basically obsolete with cars built after, I don't know, maybe like, I'll get the actual date to you, but it's like maybe 2010 or something like that.
It's two different issues. One has to do with warming the engine up to make the engine safe for driving. The other one is warming the engine up to heat your cabin.
Yeah, I don't really
think the latter is not covered anymore. It still takes a while to heat up the car, to heat up the cabin. It is safe to drive the car without letting it warm up for a while. Two different issues. My son's an auto engineer.
Okay, let's get that second draft going, and then we'll circulate it and discuss further. Next. Tiffany asked for a law. I will post it now.
I can do that if you want.
You got it? All right, okay. Go ahead.
I got it. In a second, I had it.
There you go.
All right. Tiffany asks for a law that provides a means for the honorary dedication of streets to name them after important people of Hudson. And she was kind enough to direct me to the City of Albany's law. So this is, literally didn't change much from the Albany law. It's a pretty comprehensive in terms of the process and the criteria. And what it basically is, it provides a means for people to nominate people who are important. The honoree must, first of all, must show a demonstrative or significant positive impact on the community or contribution to cultural, economic, et cetera, or was in the service of humanity, which does not mean that it's limited to the community. The honoree must be a natural person and not a living person unless it's agreed to unanimously by the council. Can't be derogatory, obscene, or blasphemous names. You can find to where it goes. You can't duplicate another name. There's a limit on how many you can propose each year. Not much of a limit. Each council member or the mayor can propose up to two a year, or a member of the public can make an application for it. There's an application fee which doesn't apply to the mayor or the common council of $50, but the application provides, you know, the relevant information and include a map of the location. And there's a process the council reviews the submission and sends it to the police department and Department of Public Works for their input. If they see any conflicts or issues of doing it. And there's a presumption that the council will act on it within 90 days. And if you don't act it on 90 days, it's deemed denied. This is just a provision, so it's not sitting around there too long. Again, you don't need this. You can take it out if you want. Okay. And then for members of the public who propose it, there's a $300 fee that I guess goes to paying for the signage. And then there are... just some information on how the signs is supposed to look. And they're valid for a period of 10 years of which they could be removed or renewed. And that's about it. That's the basic elements of it.
Okay, Tiffany has a question or a comment. Oops,
thank
sorry.
You, Jeff.
Okay, Tiffany has a, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. I had submitted the law along with my suggestions and that we would like to see. And I had suggested, I believe, the first Black woman, African-American woman on the council, Miss Bell. And the signage would say with her first and last name's Way. And I also suggested for Ed Cross, who also served on the county supervisor, for many years, I believe 20 years. And also for the fifth ward, for Doc Donahue, for Doc's Way. All three have contributed to the community and to Hudson. And this is our way, and my suggestion, to honor them. And hopefully with the work that we're doing, someday somebody would want to honor us the same.
Well, we're not considering names tonight, but we are considering the law. Ryan, you wanted to say something?
I just had a question about putting that $300 number in there, because arguably the cost of a sign could be cheaper than that or a little bit more. I mean, I don't know if we had DPW weigh in, or do we just change the wording instead of what the fee number is to read whatever the cost, because that's what we're asking public to cover, right, Jeff, is just the cost of production of the sign if it gets approved.
Well, I don't know how Albany came up with this. It also could be a minor revenue raiser.
You know, there's costs to putting it up as well. So
as the process of going through it, it's certainly, you know, this is something you want to go forward on. I think we should certainly send it around to Rob and get his.
That's my only comment.
Input on it anyway. And that cost, I mean, you know, one of the things also is I thought of doing, it might require us to change a little more laws. I have to look, is put that fee sort of in your regular fee structures.
Right.
And list it as things that you change periodically so you don't have to change the law when it does. On the other hand, it's a pretty straight and high number. So, you know,
right.
You can go either way.
Right. We don't hold on a second, Tiffany. I was speaking because we don't want to get to have fees in laws, which sort of led us to a problem last time.
Right.
So it's better to have the fee separate from the law. Go ahead, Tiffany.
That's my only suggestion.
Yes. Tiffany?
Okay.
That can easily be removed with a pen or with the digital type. But anyway, with the change in the signage, nothing dramatic would have to be changed as far as the postal service changing addresses or anything of that nature. Everything would remain the same, and the signage would go right underneath.
They're stacked, right?
Second.
Usually goes above, doesn't
yeah.
it?
She's correct, Tom, because I think by law you've got to have the actual street. So if it was like North 2nd Street, then the honorarium is just for legal purposes. Yeah.
It's a wonderful way to give back and with recognition.
Okay, any other comments?
I just want to support this. It seems like, great. I can't see any problems with that.
Okay, moving right along. Jeff, where do we stand with the inclusionary zoning?
We have Michelle here. She's been doing some good work trying to gather more information as to how we can make this work or what makes it viable. I don't know, Michelle, if you want to say anything on this or not. I don't want to put you under the spot.
All right. So been doing feasibility analysis, gathering data, and not done yet, but so far it looks like it's economically feasible to have inclusionary zoning for definitely larger residential units. So I don't have an exact number on what larger means, but I'd definitely say like 10 and above or so. And so one thing we were looking at is Hastings on Hudson is very similar to us. They're about 2 square miles. And they have an inclusionary zoning ordinance that is mandatory for buildings that are 8 and above. And so basically theirs says that 15% of units and new developments have to be set aside for either workforce or affordable housing. They say of that 15%, 2/3 has to be affordable, which they define as 60% AMI or below, and the other one third could be affordable or workforce, which they define as 80% AMI or below. And then the alternatives, if it goes to the planning board, they have a discussion there and say that this isn't feasible for some reason, then the owner developer could pay a fee that's equal to the cost of the construction of those units or construct a unit offsite. So that would be the alternatives. And then there's also possible density bonus of 10% under certain circumstances. So that's an example in New York. I've been trying to get in touch with them to figure out how that's been going. So in terms of how it's been going, I don't know yet.
Can you send us a copy of their language?
Sure, yeah. I can, don't have my work computer now, but I can pull up the e-code and give it to y'all to look at.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to continue. I'm trying to get, it's hard to get accurate data on terms of construction we have for the smaller size units, because Rebecca originally wanted this to be to 4 units minimum. But so I don't have data yet on whether that's economically feasible. So I'm still working on that.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any other questions for Michelle? So with that information, Jeff, can we, how far, how much more do we need?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, we're getting more guidance on what we're doing. And again, you know, it's sort of the questions, do we want to write this now as focusing it on the larger parcels or larger projects, or do you want to make it going down to the smaller ones? When that's why Michelle's also trying to find, get the information from Hastings on what their experience has been with this.
And it does seem like it would be maybe smart to go ahead and make a zoning for the one, for what we know for the larger complexes. Maybe I think we were maybe like 8 and above, something like that, or I don't know.
I think Michelle said 10, but I don't know what the where she, you know, which one it is. I mean, so we can do it for that and target it for the bigger ones.
Okay.
And
the idea that we can amend it.
Sure.
No. Like if, I mean, Michelle,
well, even, you know, in the future, you can amend it. So.
Yep.
Okay. Let's go ahead with that then. If there's no further comments.
Are we agreed on 8 or 10 to start? I would vote for 10 since that seems to be the information, you know, that Michelle has gathered.
Well, why don't we all take a look at the e-code and see what it really says and figure out whether that is actually right for Hudson's scale, you know?
So we'll leave that open right now, Jeff, as 8 or 10.
Thank you, Tom.
And we can decide that after looking at the e-code and moving right along. Okay.
I sent you a note, Tom. I had a question, and I don't remember what we did.
I know. I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, I think I circulated this, didn't I? A revised one? That's what I couldn't tell what I did.
Yes, and did we submit it? We had to submit it. Did we?
Well, and I don't think we did. That's where I looked. Oh, I didn't see it on our agendas. I'm not sure we did.
Okay, let me check with Tracy.
What are you talking about?
We're talking about whether we have change the R4 zoning so that it would accommodate Basil Nooks and any other potential building like that. We had to submit it because of a zoning change. We have to submit it to both planning boards,
that's
right?
We had to send it to the we had to introduce it and send it to the planning board.
So I think we did introduce it and we intended to send it. So let me check with Tracy to make sure we sent it.
Yeah.
Because.
Didn't they just have a meeting?
Excuse me?
Didn't the planning board just have a meeting recently, right?
They have a meeting coming up next week.
Yeah. They get 30 days.
The next meeting is next Thursday.
And just to be clear, Tiffany, they get the letter. They don't have to respond. It's just an advisory response anyway.
I wonder if it got transmitted to them or if it was seen, because I know I was just reviewing their agenda, and it's not on it.
Okay, I'll check into that.
But and also how it got transmitted, because Craig may not have seen it, and he helps prepare the agenda. So
right.
That's a good question.
Okay, so we'll look into that. About sidewalks, let me say that Ryan and I have worked on a map that allows us to actually do what we need to do, which is identifying all those spaces that will not be included in the district because they don't have sidewalks. It's a map that was buried in the files, and Ryan has made some copies. If anybody would like to see one, we could also use some help. Because it means, you know, checking out every sidewalk or potential sidewalk spot in the city. So Ryan's done a lot already. Ryan, you want
to? Yeah, I can just add to that, too. Since if we can get people to help with it, the other work that can be done to piggyback is to identify the spots where trees used to be that were either never replanted or whatnot. So this would serve many purposes if we're able to inventory together.
Great. I do that. I love walking the city. So.
All right. I'm holding you to that, John.
Yeah.
Anyone else who wants to help?
Walk every day, man.
Yeah. No, it's cool. This is really, these are great maps for doing this kind of project. So that's the latest on sidewalks. What else? We got the street names. Oh, one thing I'd really like us all to think about, and this is just, this is coming from me. I had a long talk with one of the attorneys at NYCOM, as well as with our attorney, Jeff Baker. What I really want to avoid this year is all the difficulties, shall we put it, of what happens when we appoint a majority and minority leader. Now, it's clear we don't have any problem appointing a majority leader because it seems like we'll probably have a Democratic majority for quite some time. But as you know from last year, we had some problems identifying things. And the best advice that I got from NYCOM is that we need to solve this on our own through our rules of order.
That's what I said.
Okay. And so we will, work on creating a rule of order that, and it's not that simple because we don't know. For example, it looks like maybe we will have 11 Democrats in the next session. Well, then how do we appoint a minority? That's what, one of the things we have to determine. Is it, is your status as a Democrat defined by, what is it defined by? Is it defined by when you became a Democrat or tried to switch a party late in the game? I mean, there's all kinds of ways. And what happens in the future if we have 9 Democrats and 2 members who both, one who belongs to, let's say, the Conservative Party and one who belongs to the Working Families Party. How do we determine a minority between those two? So these are the questions. Excuse me?
We vote.
Well, I think Jeff was thinking there may be some.
That's how we've done it in the past. Has
that actually happened in the past where there are just two single? Not in recent time. I mean, last time it was Dominic and Rebecca, but Dominic was not a member of a party.
I'm talking about way in the past.
Okay.
The caucus voted.
Well, the difference is that when it's what you're referring is to the caucus deciding to do.
Right.
So what do you do with, you can't, if you don't, a caucus of one can't decide, or you have two parties, someone's Working Families and somebody's Conservative, somebody's Independence Party.
But if the majority of the caucus is Democrats, then they're the ones that make
caucus by definition, caucus means just within the party. It doesn't mean the full council. So you'd only be a caucus in one party could not vote on the representation of the caucus for another party. I don't know if they deal with this issue. My thought was trying to see how the state does it, where they have any variety of laws that give appointment provisions to minority and majority members of the respective houses. And I don't know when was the last time they had a third party member in the assembly or something, but in theory they do. And a lot of them are cross endorsed by Conservative Party or whatever. And Working Families, again, same thing. I don't know how they deal with that and how that's written in. I mean, our laws generally shouldn't presume a Republican and Democratic split.
So
as the only parties that matter,
right? You know,
for obvious reasons, that's offensive.
So what I'm proposing is that we think about this. We're not going to make a decision tonight. I just want to put it on the table for us all to think about and come up with ideas. But it would be nice to get it into the rules of order before we start the next session in January.
But like I said, in my experience, the caucus had voted to make that decision. Even if we had.
I'm not sure what you're...
Invite someone in, you know, to speak. The caucus would vote on that.
Vote on
and
what?
And that's what we did in the past.
Vote on what?
On the decision of who would take that seat from minority leader.
I know, but that actually makes no logical sense, because why should a caucus of one party determine who's a minority leader from...
Because the majority...
Oh, you mean if everybody's Democrat?
Yes, well, not everybody, but majority of the caucus, the majority of the council, everyone is Democrat, and they will be the ones that would vote to make the decision on who would be the minority leader.
If there's no minority member.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what I suggested to Jeff, but that's probably...
That's the easy part.
Right, that's the easy part. It's when we get these odd things, like if we have two other party members...
And what
party.
Happens if everyone is a Democrat and everyone was registered as a Democrat when the election happened, and then upon taking office or sometime later, they change to the Conservative or Working Family, and now they say, I'm the minority leader.
So we need to define, also looking at the Board of Elections, like when they define your status. I mean, I don't believe you become a member of the party you change... the moment you apply. Is that correct, Jeff?
I think the only restrictions is there are certain windows when you can change your party registration. Okay. And some of it has to do with dates before the primary, because that's all that matters is your ability to vote in a primary.
Right.
So I think there are some windows where you cannot change your affiliation, but I think that's it.
Okay. Thank you. So everyone give thought to that. We'll talk about
research.
Yep. And lastly, I don't know, John, did you want to bring this up tonight? You're muted.
Yeah, for a matter of fact, for process, but I mean, it's my opinion that we should go directly to the informal from here without much debate, since it's fairly settled. And I think it could just be some revised language on part of the resolution. Speaking about, I've submitted to Tom a resolution that's been brought to the attention of myself, Rebecca Wolf, and Jane Trombley from Concerned Citizens about
can everybody claiming see
or stating our title to the 4.4 acres that aren't really in dispute, that are adjacent to the dock property that Coloriso owns. So this basically, this resolution, which essentially states fact, you can't alienate public land. The sale of that land in 1980 was done erroneously. And we are essentially declaring its city ownership and then initiating the process to do that. So
you want to lead us through it more specifically, or?
I mean, I think it's very matter of fact. I think the council should endorse it, and whether or not there has to be any small changes to the language, we could discuss that, but I believe it's been well settled by both title searches in the past. I think previous administration seemed to drag their feet on the obvious that the city does in fact own the land. And given that riverfront property, public lands can't be alienated by in any such way unless done by this state legislature. that this instance of 4.4 parcel giving being sold by the city illegally to a private owner in 1980, we should address this back now and claim it for our own. And I think it's the public wants it, and I think it's good policy on our part to do it.
Tiffany, you your hand up.
I do, but not pertaining to this.
Oh, okay. Does anybody? Yes, Jeff.
I only gave this a quick review, and I gave it, and I know Cheryl gave it a quick review. A couple points. I would like to review it more closely. I think there's some factual errors in, you know, what's laid out in the history and the whereas provisions that should get cleaned up. More importantly, my understanding is there's no disagreement, and there's no disagreement with Colarusso that title on this vests with the city. I don't think they've disagreed with that. I think the issue of providing access to it is one of the things that the planning board is looking at now and is already written into the zoning code. When Cheryl did this, it requires all of that. So I'm not sure what the purpose of this or how, you know, it's supposed to apply. I think I'll look at it more carefully and be a little, a little careful on what the city is doing on this while we're undergoing our review.
That understood and granted, I still say if it's a pretty simple matter and both the private landowner and the city both agree that we control the land, then if anything for the symbolism of it, then we should declare it so and move ahead rather than, since it's not controversial. In terms of access to that, that's something that we're not going to dictate, certainly to the planning board, but I think broadly speaking, if it's public land, you should say that any private operator or landowner adjacent to it should do what is right, which is to, and historic, which is to provide access to public land along the waterfront. So to me, it's pretty straightforward. So without really hemming and hawing much about it, I think we just proceed. And if you have some edits, Jeff, that's fine. But I think we should move ahead with this next week.
Well, let me say about making some edits and, you know, and go over with Cheryl something we can introduce next week.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Tiffany, did you have something you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, I do. This was brought to me last year, I believe, by one of the council members, but for whatever reason, they decided not to bring forward, but I think I would like to bring it forward. Many of you may have or may have not seen that we have a lot of people in the city that are non-drivers, and they depend on collecting bottles as an extra means of income. And they walk generally from the second ward, from the first ward, with shopping carts or bicycles, with garbage bags, multiple overfilled bags with plastic, you know, containers to get the refund of 5 cents. And they're literally walking from there all the way to ShopRite, or even further if that machine isn't working. There is a law, from my understanding, where stores that you purchase from is supposed to collect the returns. And I don't see that enforced anywhere. I would like to the council to think about this, where maybe somewhere in on our city property, where we can have a station set up where we have our own machine that collects cans and recycle and so forth. So that way our residents aren't putting their lives at risk walking from here all the way to Greenport just to have that extra income. And we see them in the rain and the snow because, you know, as we all know, it adds up and people need. And I would like to be able, as council members, as representative, to help them out with that. And I think that that would benefit everyone in the city, and maybe even also looking into these corner stores, or any store for that matter, that sells sodas or whatever that has the symbol on it, to get that 5-cent refund to collect them.
Thank you. Ryan, you have a question?
Can I hear you?
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Ryan, you have your hand up?
Oh, no, I like it. And I've seen it actually in other communities, Tiffany, where they actually partner with grocery stores that may be a little bit further away. So like in this example, right, like if ShopRite could give us a machine to put downtown, it's not even the money that comes back out of it. It's a voucher that they can then take and put toward, you know, buying food for the house kind of a thing. So I love this because I've seen it in action before.
We need to do this ASAP. I know one of the people that was faithfully collecting, you know, they put their lives at risk. I've seen a gentleman, you know, with so many bags that if he sees a plastic bottle on the ground, he will literally stop just to pick that up to add to the collection, while the cart may start flowing backwards or, you know, anything to that extent. And I know another woman that passed away, you know, from always walking and being in the cold doing that. So I think that, you know, thank you, Wallace, for supporting the idea, and I think we should make it happen.
One thing I can say, that the local stores, if they sell the product, they can't deny the return. When my dad at the store, you sell the product, you can't deny a return. Now, if you don't sell the product, then because you didn't sell that. But if you sell Pepsi, you have to take the Pepsi return.
And I totally agree with you, Dominic. And that's what I stated, that the corner stores are supposed to take them back, but they're not. And you know, that's going to be what another task to give the police to enforce, to mandate. I mean, we can do that in the future. You know, so that can be distributed throughout all city wards and not just downtown. But for now, as a start, with the people that we notice from downtown, I'd like the idea of maybe partnering with ShopRite and possibly Walmart too. You know, we can have that in the fifth ward, the first, between first and second ward. It would be beneficial for our constituents.
I know there's a new place on Healy Boulevard, and I do think there's the benefit that it's something to come, because, you know, with the recycles, you know, the more a company like ShopRite, they also, when they return, they get, you know, more money than 5 cents. They actually get more money on a case when they return it. So it would benefit them to, you know, a company to come in. You know, I know Co-Work tried to do it at one time, and it didn't work. And I think it was because of their location in Mellonville. They had a center out there, but because of their location. But I think finding a key location would be a great asset if it's a key location that's very accessible locally.
Thank you, Dominic. Ryan, you wanted to speak again?
Yeah, Tiffany, and I'll work with you on it. We're overlooking the obvious. Isn't the Aldi going to be the closest one to all of us within Hudson once it's completed? So from a promotional standpoint,
I would like to have one in the city. I mean,
I'm saying, like, in terms of businesses that might be like wanting to do it, right? Like they want to be more well known. So it's like, hey, here's an opportunity for you to really help the community out. So that could be a way to approach.
Let's work together. And if anybody else would like to join us, but let's get on it, Ryan.
On it. I'll call you tomorrow.
Okay. Moving right along. We've actually covered a lot very quickly. And I would like to open it up to the public. Oh, before that, I see Rebecca has her hand up. Rebecca, go ahead.
I did have some new business.
Sorry.
A amendment to the good cause law that we just passed. There were some unwanted loopholes in there or clauses, and I can it's pretty small and or it's pretty clear, so if I could just go over what it is basically.
Okay. Go ahead.
Are you ready? Okay, so in the first, I don't know what to call it, the first numeral of the law, it says the court may consider, among other factors, and we need to delete the rate of the increase relative to the tenant's ability to afford said increase. And then we need to delete significant market changes relevant to the subject unit. And so that, so that's number of the current, of the way that we pass the law, it needs, it's number one.
Let's just, can you phrase it, we would, that you would
like to... Can I just interrupt 1 second?
Sure, go ahead, mm-hmm. Jeff.
Is Kamal scheduled already has a public hearing scheduled on this one. And he's, I don't know if he's assigned this yet.
Assigned what?
The law.
The law.
Oh, okay. So what does that mean?
It just, we should ask him to hold it and not do it if we're going to make an amendment on it. Otherwise, we're going to be going through the process twice.
Means contact your mayor.
We can find out and ask him to withdraw the, I have to see if we can do that, actually.
Yeah, the public hearing is tomorrow afternoon.
Okay, okay, Michael, can you...
Well, he could also just veto it and say it's going through an amendment. I got to go back and check what we have in the charter in terms of the times and when he must act. That's what I'm being cautious about. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the simple one is he could say, we're going to make corrections to it. I'm going to veto this. I support it or whatever. And then we'll go back and fix it.
Okay.
Okay.
Is that the only significant change, Rebecca?
There's one more, okay. Which is on the next page, number 9.
Mm-hmm.
Should just be deleted.
Could you read that out loud, please?
It says, the owner landlord has in good faith entered into a contract for the sale of the housing accommodation, and such contract requires that the housing accommodation be transferred free and clear of any and all residential tenancy obligations as a condition of such sale, where the owner landlord has no shared financial or other interest with the potential buyer other than the sale of the housing accommodation in question, and submitted sufficient proof to the court thereof.
I think taking that out, that's in there for particular legal reasons, I think. And I think taking that out makes it more problematic.
This is the way that the law has been passed in most other cities in New York.
Who else has approved it already besides Hudson and Albany?
Hold on a minute. Just a sec.
I think it's going to.
It's been passed in Kingston, Ulster, Newburgh, Beacon, and Poughkeepsie.
Okay.
Or at least these are the. I can't attest to whether it's been passed, but these are the campaigns that are either passed or ongoing to pass it, and this is how they're doing it.
Beacon has not passed because I talked to them today. They are okay. In the process of considering it.
And yeah, I mean, I sort of understand Jeff's reluctance here about striking that without more investigation, because it ties a contract of sale between two private entities, in a sense, sets up a de facto rent stabilization, rent control system, because you're mandating that a new owner of a property has to maintain a contract that was withheld without their consent and negotiation.
Well, I think what it also does, though, is it tries to remove the possibility that a tenant can just be evicted because the house is being sold.
I support that generally, but I think we have to be really careful to make sure that we're not really going too far down a road that we can't do, which is if it's a private contract or a sale. So mm-hmm. Jeff has to.
So let's see what happens in terms of the mayor tomorrow. Michael, we task you with that. And then we'll figure out how to proceed next. I agree. The first one definitely should be removed. in my opinion. So let's see where we stand after tomorrow, and then we'll proceed.
Okay.
Anything else from council members?
Motion to adjourn.
No, 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 Tiffany. Oh. We got to listen to the public first.
I'm sorry, I thought we did.
No. So anyone from the public have anything they'd like to say or ask?
Hello, Tom and everybody. It's Ron Kupnicki.
Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi, Ron.
How are you all? I was interested in the question about choice of minority leader,
mm-hmm.
because you actually did deal with this in your rules of order after the controversy, which was early in 2020. I didn't necessarily agree with what you did because you made people who are not party members ineligible to hold either office, which I think was a mistake. But I'm glad to see that you're revisiting this issue, and I hope that when it comes up before the council, the public is given an opportunity to participate. One thing I'd like to mention on that score is I noticed that since Zoom meetings have been renewed, the public option of raising your hand doesn't seem to appear in the menu anymore. I don't, at least not on my computer. It used to be there before, and now it's not there. You can unmute yourself, but you cannot raise your hand.
Really?
Mine does.
Well, if you're a member, as far as I can tell, and maybe it has something to do with my computer, members of the group that's having the meeting, the official members, can raise their hands, but members of the public cannot.
Well, Sam Rodens, the journalist, just raised her hand.
Okay, well, I don't see the menu. I don't see it on my menu, so maybe it has something to do with the version of Zoom that I'm using.
You put it in reactions.
Margaret Morris just raised her hand. So.
Yeah, right there.
Because I don't see it on the menu. I see the members of the public or other members of the public are able to do it. So anyway, that's just a side issue. But to get back to the main issue, I'm glad you're reconsidering the, issue of how minority leaders and majority leaders are chosen. One suggestion I might have is if everyone is a Democrat, if there's any kind of contest for the leadership and the caucus, namely the whole council, were to vote, the person who came in second for majority leader might then be considered as the minority leader. So,
okay, thank you.
That's my
Margaret. Did you want to talk, or are you just demonstrating that?
No, no, I did want to talk.
Okay,
I had posted a comment in chat.
Correct.
To everyone regarding whether or not there's any actual data relating to the idling of cars,
mm-hmm.
and shortly after I had posted that chat. To everyone, chat was disabled.
That is correct.
I assume that's because public comment was not warranted at that time.
No, that is not the reason. We do not include chat because, think of it, this is supposed to recreate the process of a public meeting. There's no sort of separate conversation going on during a public meeting unless you're whispering to the person next to you. Aside from that, it has to be then become part of the record of the meeting. So it's best policy to allow no chat, and it was my mistake of not turning off chat. We generally do not. What?
Thank you for that clarification.
Sure, you're welcome.
I was simply raising a question about whether or not there's data.
Which it was, and it was raised. So.
Yes, I did see that.
Okay.
And
in fact, that was crucial. If a chat does appear. It's sort of obligatory to then sort of address it as part of the meeting to enter it as part of the record. So
I did see that the members of this meeting did address the question. Thank
exactly.
you for that.
You're welcome.
With regard to the minority leadership,
mm-hmm.
I think that we need to be very clear on the parties that people are running on. We have a situation in Hudson where people run on multiple lines. That's a kind of common situation. I think that it is problematic for Democrats, and you know, the vast majority of people in Hudson are Democrats. I think that it is problematic for people to run on a Democratic line and only on a Democratic line to be voting on who should be the minority leader for Republicans or for other parties. I think that
I'm not sure I follow you. When, how does that ever happen?
I'm just saying that one of the issues that was raised was that the majority on the council should be able to determine who the minority representative should be. And I think that...
No. I think you misunderstood. It was only in a case where everybody was a Democrat.
Perhaps I misunderstood then, Tom.
Yeah, no.
But
there was no way Democrats would be able to say a single Republican couldn't be the minority. Just not possible.
I just feel that it's very important for people who are not Democrats to be able, whether they are working party primarily and not Democrats, whether they are Republicans and not Democrats, I think that it is very important for the non, because we are more than 90% Democrat town. I think it's very important for the representatives on the council who are not Democrats to be able to elect their own minority leader.
Of course.
Without input from Democrats.
Of course.
I just wanted to say
okay. that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're welcome. With that, any other public comments? And Tiffany, do you have something you'd like to say, perhaps?
I would like to say motion to adjourn.
Thank you. Second?
Sorry, Tom. Before you second that, I do want to say one other thing.
Okay.
And it relates to the idling law. And I want to come back to some of the issues that Tiffany raised and some of the problems that I see. And yes, we are all in favor of not having people idle their cars for no apparent reason, particularly idling empty cars. But there can be significant and important reasons why a car may idle with a passenger, a young baby, for example, in a very hot temperature or in a very cold temperature with a guardian in the car, with another adult going in to get pharmacy or other things. There may be very good reasons for that to be a reasonable thing to do. And I will say, in my own experience, when my son was born in Texas, in a very hot temperature, as we were returning from the hospital when he was 30 hours old, he and I sat in the car while his father went in to get supplies. And we sat in the car with the car running and the air conditioning on for valid reasons for about 10 minutes while we waited for his father to come back out with what we needed. And so I think that whole idling law needs to be looked at very carefully. Idling an empty car is not reasonable. Idling a car with people in it may very well be reasonable. May be reasonable in very cold temperatures and may be reasonable in very hot temperatures. And as this has been proposed, it is not taking into account the nuances of why a car with people in it may actually idle either with the heat on or with the air conditioning on. I think that we really need to think about that.
Okay, thank you. Rebecca, I don't think we need to answer that unless you feel compelled to.
I mean, I think it's just worth underlining that idea with the basic premise of the law, which is that car what Jeff suggested, which is that people attempting to regulate their own small universes is not actually a sustainable way of proceeding in the world, and that essentially, it's just not something that can continue essentially in line with the basic understanding that we have that emissions need to be reduced by a tremendous percentage. So, people being too hot or too cold, it's a little subjective, don't you think? And basically it's there's plenty of people who are sort of
considerate and just take it that Margaret is saying we need to look into the law a little better, but making those comments about being too hot or too cold, I think that's very rude and you need to consider.
Okay. No. We're not going to call each other rude or whatever.
I'm stating the facts. It's not a fact.
Tiffany, I'm sorry. It's not a fact that she's being rude.
Like, you need to consider people's health and the reasons. And that's what Margaret is saying.
Well, and Rebecca's saying that others need to consider the health of the planet and all of us. I mean, this is not worth going back and forth on.
I'll just say, I have babies too. I get out of the car with them.
Okay. There's a motion on the, there's a first on the, an introduction on the floor for adjournment.
I made that motion to adjournment, but at the same time, we have to make it clear that no one is disagreeing about the climate and our health. We all want to live, and we know we can't live forever, but we want to live safely as possible. That's why I stated earlier, what's next? We're going to stop people from smoking cigarettes on the sidewalks? They can't smoke it in the park. But anyway, motion to adjourn.
Seconded.
Thank you. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone object?
And no. I quit cigarettes.
Okay. Okay, thank you all.
Good night.
Bye.